This is Game Theory, a podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother Chris. In this episode, we help you make decisions. It's called the secretary problem, and it works like this. Imagine you're a boss. You are, of course. And you need a new secretary. You post the job online and get 100 applicants. And because you're so busy, you hope to hire someone based on only one interview. So you can't bring someone in for a second interview. You either hire them or you move on. How do you make your choice? How can you tell that the person you just interviewed will be the best candidate? What if you pass on the best candidate and end up hiring someone not as qualified? Well, there's a mathematical solution that gives you the best odds for figuring this all out. It's called optimal stopping. But it raises questions around information, priorities, and what aggressive decision-making really is. Welcome to episode 105 of Game Theory, podcast about competition strategy, decision-making. Chris, we did not put out an episode last week, and there were some technical difficulties in reposting our Valentine's Day episode, and I want to say, anyone who's ever moved can understand, you just couldn't do it.
There's nothing I could do. My hands are tied behind my back. I've complained about this plenty on the show, and I appreciate you all for giving me the support that I need in this trying time. I moved from one wonderful home to another wonderful home, and I think I'm ready to say I'm never going to move again. I think I'm just going to hunker down here and they can evict me and I'll see what happens. No, moving was tough. I don't really like it. I don't envy people who move very often. It's a challenging experience, and as a result of that, our hobbies, which is to say this podcast, suffered directly.
Yeah.
You know, we talk a big game about trying to get better every day, about trying to do the right things, about getting pucks deep and getting pucks in the net. And that was just a low effort for me. And there's nothing I could do about it.
No, I mean, we missed episodes when I was moving this summer too. It happens. So
we did.
I do have a dating game update.
Match good.
Company, which owns Tinder, maybe Hinge and Match.com. I don't know who they own. Some big ones. They are facing an enormous class action lawsuit that is alleging, and apparently with some good proof, that they are not trying to match you up with anyone and instead avoiding matching you up with people in your algorithm, and they just want to get you addicted to keep on the app. And my thoughts are, nah, what? That doesn't.
I'm so shocked to hear that.
That doesn't sound right. They use gambling strategies, they say. Gambling addiction is what's being used.
Well, I mean, that sounds right, because the number one thing to remember about any kind of digital product, if you haven't really consciously thought about this, the number one goal of any kind of electronic user thing is to sell ad revenue.
Yeah.
And you can't sell ad revenue if you don't get fresh people, fresh eyes, fresh page loads onto your site.
Yep.
There's this website I used to use every once in a while. It's called freerice.com. I don't know if it still even really exists. I'm gonna double check that right now, but this freerice.com is built on that model of like, okay, every time you load a page, new ads are going to pop up. And what happens with Free Rice is kind of the same thing that happens with every other website, which is every time an ad pops up, there's a certain going rate that the company that paid for that ad gets paid. Mm-hmm. Except in this case, the website hosting the ad just donates that money to, I think it's like a UN certified charity or something. The money from ad revenue goes to fund people, and it's like to give people free rice in like developing countries, and it's part of a charity program. But the whole point is that every time you load a new page on Free Rice or on any site, the person who's hosting it gets some kind of money, some kind of benefit. So the company Match makes a lot of money if people are using Match, and people don't use Match if they already have a Match or unless they're cheating. So they're trying to maximize their user base because that's what brings in the big bucks.
So freerice.com does not sound like a very sustainable business model to me, and it makes sense, though, but it's a good idea. I like it. Sort of like Wikipedia. We're going to donate, like Bumba socks. We're going to donate money every time you use our thing. That's nice. I hope that they're still in business.
Well, we're not partnering with Free Rice or anything. This is just kind of came up because I thought of the ad revenue. So this is from their about section. Private sponsors match the rice grain donations generated within Free Rice, triggering a financial payment to WFP, which I think is it's a UN organization. Mm-hmm. The money goes into the pot of greatest need support for the organization's ongoing emergencies. 100% of all funds generated via Free Rice go to the World Food Program. Okay, so WFP is the World Food Program. Mm-hmm. Free Rice does not earn or keep any money it raises. So basically, it's like a quiz site, by the way. That's the draw. It's not just like, okay, everyone, let's go to the page and keep refreshing. It's like, oh, do you want to do like little, you know, English language quizzes? Or it's kind of like Sporkle, but what if people, instead of giving ad revenue to the company that runs Sporkle, they're giving charitable food donations to the World Food Program? So kind of a cool website, but it's built, again, on this model of the more people use the website and the more times the pages load, the more ads pop up and the more money goes into the pocket of the person who's hosting the website. So you're saying Natch is being hit with this like, oh no, everyone figured out this isn't about love and romance. This is about profitability for a business.
Yep.
So whoopsie.
Yeah. And it's created, people kind of sniffed it out, and it's created a general distrust of the companies. And so it's kind of a fascinating thing. I have other updates too for other episodes that we've done. Seattle has enacted an ordinance that would require people to pay more money up front for things that they buy on DoorDash. And as a result of that, no one's ordering DoorDash. And so DoorDashers are like, no one's ordering anymore. And then they're like, And tips, not only are they ordering less, but tips are way down because they're like, well, I'm paying more up front. So DoorDash would just kind of, somebody would pocket the money, maybe the restaurants. I don't know. This is completely backfired. We'll wait to see how it plays out over time, but maybe we might be revisiting a DoorDash rideshare kind of episode.
So is this a fee that goes to like the city of Seattle? Is it just like an additional tax, or like how is it that Seattle is just making people pay more money for food delivery?
So I don't understand exactly who gets the money, and I've looked at this a little bit, but from what I understand, the goal was to make a minimum salary for Dashers, like a livable wage if that was your career, at $26 an hour, $26.40 an hour. This is above Seattle's required minimum wage of $19.97 an hour. And now even DoorDash, the company, is responding to, like, this is like on DoorDash's official website 1 month later, evaluating the harmful impacts of Seattle's new delivery laws because people have to pay more. So DoorDash is not eating the cost. They're like, yeah, fuck off. We're going to make the consumer eat the cost. And the consumer's like, no, in this economy, no. So people, like, it just kind of killed this service.
Well, it's interesting that, so the law is based on the expectation that food delivery, which is a career that did not exist 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, when did DoorDash even become a company? Yeah. So like you think of food delivery, you think of, like, I don't know, like Chinese takeout and pizza delivery,
yeah, basically. Old school pizza.
And like, that's like a job for high school kids. So yeah. Like, it's like the notion that this job, which did not exist before the gig economy popped up, this is like a creation of really the last several years. I mean, I didn't have a college degree the last time it's just crazy that this has come up, and now the expectation is that, like, by rule of the city government, by the abstraction that is the city government of Seattle, now people have to are entitled to a livable wage doing this thing. Yeah. I think we have lost the plot here.
Yeah.
Because the consequence is just that people are going to stop using the app because it's too expensive. It's not sustainable. So it really, then the service is going to be, it's going to be gone. Like, this wasn't designed to like people didn't come up with the concept of food delivery as a way to, like, give people a livable wage. They did it to make money for the owner. Like, that's why businesses exist. So this notion is, I think the city of Seattle is probably, unfortunately for the people, it's seeing the fruit of its labor to try to get food delivery drivers a livable wage. That's not what this is about. That's not what this is for.
Yeah.
And I think we're putting the cart before the delivery horse here.
Right. So yeah, the cart before the Grubhub horse or whatever. So this has been a DoorDash thing, but Grubhub.
That's interesting. Uber, but we'll have to revisit that, like you said, in a later episode, because this is the first I've heard about this. I didn't know they were doing that.
A couple upcoming episodes as well. We're going to do AI-generated content. It's time with Sorrow, OpenAI's text-to-video thing. Also, something taking the internet by storm, that Madam Web, and you're a comic book nerd, Madam Web is so bad that one of the conspiracy theories that's been floated among many, and honestly, the crashing and burning of this movie is something that I cannot look away from on the internet. I find TikToks and tweets about it. I soak all of them. And so here's the theory. The theory is that this script was largely put together during the writer's strike and that Sony is kind of soft launching AI generated scripts. And from scenes that I have heard that are in the movie that are really dumb and out of place, and how the apparently the actors were not allowed to deviate from dialogue, which is really obvious. If you ever watch a movie, you're like, man, having to say that, it really sticks out like a sore thumb. Maybe you should have let Ashton Kutcher make his own choice there. It's kind of like there's a scene in the movie where, and I haven't seen it, I've just seen people talk about it, where all three of the young girls, Sydney Sweeney and her co-stars, are like dancing on the table. We're like, that seems like something AI would have been like, this is what people like. Or like there was a scene where someone stole a car to get to a location, and then from that location, instead of driving the stolen car, steals another car. Like this, like that sound, it sounds, that conspiracy theory vibes to me.
Wow. So we're butting up against the very real possibility that because much of the early production of this took place during the writer's strike, yep, and SAG, like during the episode, you know, see our episode on that.
Yeah, correct.
Because much of the production of this movie took place during that period, we could be seeing the fruits of an AI-generated script and production process.
Everybody's, oh, it's just no, a conspiracy theory, but everyone's like, this feels like AI, right? And everyone's looking around like, kind of. It's that bad.
It's like those it's like those Jesus commercials, like the He Gets Us, yep, commercials,
really,
that were in the Super Bowl.
Well,
like those
done,
are
written good stuff though.
Like they well, do it. I mean, like AI. There's one that was like, yeah, they're clearly AI. And like you gotta like kind of study the hands, but the hands look too posed.
Hands,
and like the
hands
writing
are
on
the AI.
Signs looks a little,
yeah,
weird.
Hands. That's, yeah, a good one. Yep. I just yeah, watched TikTok about centaurs. Can't do centaurs. AI doesn't know.
Oh, well, that's a good thing for all the centaurs out there.
Right, exactly.
Their identities are going to be protected.
Equality. Okay, so since you were moving, you're fighting a house, let's get into this episode. So we're going to do AI-generated content. We're going to do an episode on insurance because we are in what's called an insurance death cycle. And that's a real thing that happens in the insurance industry. It happens every like 30 years or so. It's a naturally occurring business cycle. I heard about this when I was a reporter in senior living, and it's happening now. Like, well, the rates are going up and people are blaming this and blaming that. It's everything. There's a confluence of things. Some of it has to do with macroeconomics. Some of it has to do with politics and climate, but some of it has to do with the insurance industry just does this every couple decades. So we'll talk about that. And I would like to do, I don't want to revisit cicadas. I want to mention this is going to be a cicada summer. Not pumped about that. Excited about the cicada summer.
No,
to be honest.
Nope. It's going to be tough. It's going to be loud out there. You better buckle up.
All right, Chris, you got a new apartment, and that segues nicely into something called the secretary problem. And secretary problem is solved using something called optimal stoppage theorem. So here's the secretary problem. The idea is this is a mathematical solution to figure out how to quickly decide how to choose one thing when there are many options. So the secretary problem works as follows. You have an opening for a secretary. You need to fill a position. You're going to hire a secretary. There are going to be 100 applicants. Very important. Finite set. 100 applicants.
Okay.
How do you decide which one is best? And you think to yourself, well, I have a hiring process. Well, when you interview number 97, you're thinking to yourself, well, I've already turned down 1 through 96. So at this point, like, it's entirely mathematically plausible, if not certain, that I've already missed the best candidate here. I'm putting a lot of pressure on the final four candidates, 97, 98, 99, and 100. So you're like, shoot, I should not have done that. There is a mathematical solution. What should you do? It works. So do you have any guesses off the top of your head? Because there's a mathematical solution.
Well, I don't have any guesses, but I do want to clarify what I know about the secretary problem is that during this interview process, it's kind of like overtime rules in sports.
Swiping.
The second I find the right candidate, then I'm good to go. I've made my hiring decision.
Correct.
It's not like a regular hiring process where like they'll have a batch of candidates, they'll interview all of them, they'll compare the interviews, and they'll do like an evaluation on the back end. It's interview, decision,
swipe left,
decision.
To swipe right. Yep.
So when the reason we're able to get to number 96 is because as the interviewees, we've already made a decision about 96 of these people. So there are four other candidates that we have to make this decision process on. And so is the question, what should I do with the remaining four?
No, the question is that, that was an example. The question is, it's day one of the interview process. What is your strategy to find your secretary?
Well, if I know there are 100 applicants, it feels like I'm not using my time optimally. If I take 1 hour per person, let's say it takes 1 hour and I've got 100 applicants, that is fully 2.5 work weeks that I'm going to spend just in this interview process. And the whole point of finding a secretary is to be more efficient. So I have to find a more efficient way of doing this. So maybe it seems to me logical to cut this process down to like, okay, if 100 is representative of a good sample, I'm probably going to find pretty good candidates in like half that pool. And yes. What are the odds that I'm going to eliminate good candidates? So I'm going to like cut the pool in half, first of all. And then maybe, I don't know, maybe cut it in half again. Maybe I drop and just do like 25% of the candidates. And it's like, okay, the odds are that a serviceable secretary will be found within this like chunk. So I would just do like 25 and say, all right, sorry, 100.
All right. You're out. So you are on the right path of thinking. So the problem has been solved through probability, statistics, decision theory. And it's been widely debated. And we're looking at this Reddit thread about the difference between ordinal and cardinal information and like how much better is one thing than the other and like what's the gap between the best decision and the second best decision. But the answer to the secretary problem is this. This is called the 37% rule, right? So you take 37% of your applicants, 37 people, and from that pool, while you have passed on all of them, you have found in there the standard bearer. Have you ever heard people say the bar is on the floor in the dating world? Well, what you do if you're looking for...
Yeah, it's because I put it there.
Right. Where is the bar? Who is the high bar? And unfortunately, because of the way the game is played, can't go back. You just like, sorry, sacrificial lamb, you're not going to get hired, but you are the bar. As soon as you find a candidate that is equal to or better than, you hire them.
Okay.
So that's how
this
works.
Well, there you go.
Right.
So all they have to do is clear the bar. It's not about being the best out of 100. It's being the first person to clear the bar.
Right, exactly. So this is the interesting part about this probability. It's one of the inherent things about making decisions, and it's kind of you see it a lot in like sports, but in real life you see it for dating perhaps, but more importantly, I think housing is the most interesting thing. I purchased a house this year, and I can tell you there's a lot of options here. What do we like? Like, do we find, is this the one? Are we being too hasty? Are we being too slow? Like, you visited apartments, and at a certain point, you're like, okay, are we just going to keep looking at apartments forever, or is this one good enough? Or when you compare it, say about a third of, if you visit three apartments, you're like, okay, so that's one, that's the baseline.
Yep.
The next two created equal to, above, or worse baseline. So that's the general idea and application of this.
Yeah, well, it seems to me like in a process like housing, a lot of the work is doing exactly what you said. It's finding what the baseline is. And, you know, in my experience of trying to figure out a house rental, obviously it's not as big of a decision impact-wise as buying a house. So I don't envy you for having to do that. You guys did end up with a banger of a home, by the way. So finally, chance for you to learn some home improvement skills. But our process was, okay, we're going to go to a bunch of different places and just kind of see what's out there. We'll use one of these sites like, you know, apartments.com or Zillow or, you know, whatever, and figure out what's out there. We're going to go look at some stuff. And we're not even necessarily going to go, oh, yeah, we want this or we don't want that. I guess that's exactly what we did, except we weren't making decisions about apartments. We were identifying where the baseline was. And that process took a little while. It was like, okay, we got to establish where exactly is the bar. And I think that, you know, shout out to my lovely partner. She did a lot of the work in identifying places to go, obviously, and figuring out what was like, okay, what are the things we actually like about our apartment? You know, I like it because I had been there for a while, but we figured out that we liked it for real tangible reasons. And so setting the bar and figuring out, okay, what do we need our next place to clear? That was where we really put in the work. And, you know, so then I'm interested in the mathematics of this process here, because this seems like an iteration type of thing where it's like, okay, if candidate two is better than candidate one, the bar has been raised. And then three is better than two, the bar is raised again. And then four is not as good as three, so the bar is still where three was. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how many people do I need to do that in order to figure out, all right, I've got the serviceable bar, and then the next person to clear it is my efficient hire. So how do you figure out where that is?
Yeah, so I don't understand the math. That's the thing I've been working at this, and I don't know. See all these characters on the screen? This is difficult to me. I will say, though, first thing to point out, because of the way that internet searching works, is that there is something called optimal stopping theorem. This is
optimal
not...
Optimal stopping theorem.
Yes, optimal stopping theorem is a different thing, or optional stopping theorem is a completely different part of probability theory. And maybe we should get into that at the latter parts of this episode, because that seems confusing.
Optional versus optimal?
Yes, optional, well, and so, optimal, right.
So let me start with what I understand about the mathematics there. So if you're talking about optimal stopping, then what you're really talking about in a very basic sense is like this is something that people learn in like calculus one or calculus two classes. Like the way to optimize something is to find out what the function looks like. And then there's a point where the slope of that thing is zero. And that means you're either at a peak or you're at a trough. Right. And so finding where those zeros are, that's what the optimum is going to be. So if this is optimal stopping theory, then I assume there's some kind of like, is there some kind of integral involved here where you got to figure out, well, I guess a derivative is going to be involved here. We got to figure out where the slope hits zero. But is that looking right to you? Or is that, I mean,
yeah. So that's the idea. And like part of the thing is so that there are a couple different variables at play. The first thing is like time. Like you don't have all day to figure this out. The second variable is it is not about finding the best candidate in the pool of 100. It is about finding one that you believe will be above. Like better than bad, right? Like one that doesn't, like mm-hmm. the best of the pool of 37, which reminds me quite a bit of something we talked about 2 years ago now when we did our medical match episode and the stable marriage problem. It's not about finding the best partners mm-hmm. for people. It's about finding the best match overall. It's like the unit, right? The sum, the mass being greater than the sum of its parts. That's what this is about. So how can I save the most amount of time and also get something representative? So the thing that I couldn't figure out is how they got a 37. Why not 45? Why not 50? And I think it's because you want to leave yourself just over, and this is like the S curve that I've seen. You want to leave yourself around 2/3 of the candidate pool remaining to give yourself the best. Like there will be someone who is close to that bar set by someone in the first third. And as a result of that, you won't, because the closer you get to 50%, it becomes less likely that you're going to find someone that's going to approach that bar. Like as you come back down the 50% mark, you're going to go below zero potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see that. So let's consider this. Let's go through the math here of deriving the optimal policy for when, and let's see what, how we can mathematically converge on that 37%. So I think there's a process of doing this, and let's start with like the simplest case where you have one candidate. That one's pretty darn easy. You can go ahead and say, all right, this person is going to be the secretary. Congratulations, you have found it. In this case, there is no optimization. I mean, it's just you got a job opening and the secretary applies and congratulations, the secretary is hired. You now have a secretary. But when you're looking at the optimal policy, you use a stopping rule like this mathematical construct. And this is just looking at the Wikipedia here. The interviewer rejects the first R minus one applicants. So if R equals two, then the interviewer is going to reject R minus one, which is two minus one, which is one. And so then for just like the mathematical purposes, let M be the best applicant among these R minus one applicants. And then the user then selects the first subsequent applicant that is better than applicant M. So it can be shown that the optimal strategy lies in this class of strategies. And there's basically a simple derivative process here where you say like, okay, what's the probability of R, of applicant I being selected for all applicants, like assuming that applicant I is the best. And there's this mathematical formula here, and I'm going to see if I can, how do I share here?
Yeah,
let's go ahead and do that. Let's do that.
Let's do it. You can do it. Yes. Yes, Boomer. Yeah, yes.
God bless technology. Whew. And so we've got right here, there's a simple integral here. So the function is equal to x times the integral from 1 to x, or from x to 1, I guess, of 1 over t dt, which is the integral of like time, I guess. I don't know. But the solution of it here is this negative x log of x. And so if you, as you change what x is, as you go along here, mm-hmm. then you can see like the probability of picking this candidate slowly goes down on this table, this solution table here.
Yep.
So and it's approaching zero. Close to 37% is what it's doing. It's getting closer and closer. And then you can see this solution here. If you were to continue this and expand out for n being a huge, huge number, the larger n goes, the closer p gets to 1 over e, which E is the famous Euler's constant. That's the that's the exponential growth number. That's that constant.
Oh.
Yeah, and so the solution approaches the inverse of that. which is why it's the 37% rule. The inverse of E is 0.368 or 0.37. That's why you get that. It's because it's this kind of integral function here where you get the solution being negative x natural log of x. Well, all you got to do is solve for x here, and it turns out that the answer is this right here. It's this 1 over E.
This person, Richard E. Bellman, kind of came up with the mathematical optimization method, which was known for dynamic programming. And this appeared in something that might be relevant to us, which was called the theory of games and economic behavior, which makes...
Wow, kind of that sounds... I feel like I've heard that before.
Stole our stuff. The idea is to find a process that can maximize what you're putting into it, which is money, time, effort, and to get something out of it. Now, I did see this Reddit thread, and I think this is interesting as we deviate from science. So the Reddit thread is about what are actual applications for this. So we should spend the first 36.8%, which is what we just found with the Euler's constant, which is this Euler's with an E. Is that's why it's a shaped E. It's not like O-I-L-E-R-S. It's like Euler's.
Yeah, so, this number comes up all over the place. And part of the reason that it comes up is it's not just like out of nowhere, like, oh yes, well, we've got this this magic Euler constant. And actually, this is genuinely true. There's more. Euler was such an important... Dude, we should do a whole episode on Euler. This guy was arguably the greatest scientist of all time. There are so many things. Like, there are literally disambiguation articles on Wikipedia because there are more than one constant name for this guy. There's a gamma function that's named for him in a completely separate field. But I guess this isn't really Euler's constant. It's called Euler's number. And I'll show again just so that you can see the disambiguation here. But the point is that this number, this 2.718 number, everybody's seen this in math class. There we go. Check that out. That's a big transcendental number. It was actually discovered by Jacob Bernoulli. And it has to do with this kind of, it occurs all over the place in logarithms. So you can see the shape of this. If things grow exponentially, well, they decay logarithmically. And the inverse of the logarithm is the exponent. And this y equals 1 over x, that's the function I'm showing you here. Yep. So y equals 1 over x, it has that shape. And if you go from 1 to Euler's constant, that total is equal to 1. That area is equal to 1. This blue part right here, for those of you who are watching on YouTube.com.
Just 1, and whatever, anyway, whatever unit. That's interesting. So I'm learning math here today.
Yeah. How about that? Right. And so, and it turns out, as you would expect, Euler's number shows up in trigonometry. It shows up in the most beautiful formula ever. It's e to the power of pi times I plus 1 equals 0. It's like basically all the mathematical stuff you need to know in one true identity. And it's based on these trigonometric relationships. But it also shows up in something called the Gaussian distribution. And Gaussian distribution is, let's see if I can find it on this page. I can't find it on this page. But the Gaussian distribution is the basic shape of the normal distribution graph. So, you know, the probability thing where you've got bins and you've got standard deviations. Yeah, so that is based on, it includes Euler's number in it. And the mathematics of how that works, like that describes probability. And one of the reasons is this 1 over x, that solution, if you do any kind of calculus with that, if you integrate with that, then the solution becomes the logarithm. And so it makes sense that this would show up because of the calculus options that are required to solve this optimal stopping problem. Because you've got a natural logarithm there in the solution, you're going to find Euler's number present in it because it's intrinsically related to exponential growth and decay. And so this 36.8%, this 37% rule, that's not coming out of nowhere. That's because of a natural mathematical relationship among growth and decay. And so this Reddit thread that we're talking about here, I mean, you can see the top comment, shout out to When I Hit the Ground from 5 years ago, quoting this piece from the Reddit thread is discussing a Medium article about using the secretary problem,
which we have,
and the quotation reads, should we spend the first 36.8% of our adult lives dating casually, then settle down with the first person we find who's better than anyone we've dated so far? Allegedly a bit of a straw man, according to When I Hit the Ground. But this 36.8%, that comes from this mathematical constant that shows up in exponential and logarithmic growth and decay.
Yes, which I think the Reddit thread does a really great job, and we can link to it in the show notes below, because I think it breaks down some other information. And I can tell you just a little bit, behind, peek behind the curtain of, I think, what would be a good business venture, and I've got some examples for this. The use of AI, quote unquote, that I'm most interested in is to comb the internet podcasts, and I'm kind of joking and I'm kind of serious, because the Reddit thread does quote a podcast from a guy named Brian Christian, I believe, who is a nonfiction author and a programmer and a scientist. He wrote a book called Algorithms to Live By and has appeared in a podcast. And Algorithms to Live By is fascinating. I've seen it pop up here and there, and I got to read it. I think it's a book that's going to be at the top of my list soon for nonfiction. I'm in the market for
it. Well, it sounds like we had to revive a certain old idea that we had once,
which was our math episodes.
No, the book club.
Oh, the book club. It is about time, summertime. We could do three books this year. It's what day is today? Today is March almost. All right.
Today is March almost. Is everything okay? All right over there?
Yeah. We're doing fine. So, Christian.
We got hockey brain. Nick's men's league hockey team is playing Bethesda Medical next week.
You done?
You like that? That's a few good men reference. You catch up?
Yeah, I did. You're a lousy softball player, Jack. Okay, Chris. Cardinal information. Nominal information and ordinal information is something I have had a difficult time wrapping my mind around in preparation for this episode. So cardinal information is numerical. Like, it gives me a value to something. Like, I have 7 carats versus 1 carat. I have 7, you have 1 carat. And I think ordinal information is just more along the lines of like up or down, like a 1 or a 0, right? I think that's what's going on here, which is fascinating, because Brian Christian said in a podcast in his discussing this book that he wrote, Algorithms to Live By, that it's important to, when approaching something like the secretary problem, take into account cardinal information. So here's the quote from the podcast. Quote, in the case of the secretary problem, your odds of success following the best strategy if you only use ordinal information is 37%. We know that. We just discussed that. I learned some math. With cardinal information, he misquoted himself, it's 58% more likely that you're going to find the best candidate. So it allows you to get the very best candidate in the entire pool more than half of the time, instead of just above one third of the time, which is the way that the secretary problem is solved using ordinal information. So it's just an interesting thing that the quality of the information. So this is kind of saying, I think that the quality of the interviews, by using cardinal information, by ascertaining something better than who's the best one, better than ranking them, like why you like them, gives you a higher likelihood of finding the best one, not just because of like what you value in your culture as a company, but because you are looking for qualitative measures, you become mathematically more likely to find the right candidate.
Yeah. And so just to return to the cardinal ordinal thing, it's just a different way of quantifying the type of information that you have. It's kind of in the same way that like relative versus absolute geography. Like I knew this dude once who told me about, it was like an anthropology major. And he said, you know, there are peoples who in history and today don't use relative geography. They don't use like right and left. They use only like the cardinal directions. And I don't know if it's the same north, south, east, west, or if it's like its own system, but it's like, okay, instead of saying, all right, exit the building, take a right turn, go 3 blocks and take a left, it would be exit the north face of the building, turn east, go 3 blocks, and then turn back north again. It's all absolute geography using the cardinal directions. Whereas with the relative directions, your frame of reference could potentially change, but the decisions that you make depend on that. And sometimes it's really useful. I would rather have cardinal directions and an orientation if I'm trying to get around a new city. But if I'm trying to play left wing, I don't want to be playing north wing when we're going toward the east. I would rather just play the left wing. So. Yeah. So you mentioned fruits as like an example of how
carrots
to
are totally
cardinal.
A fruit. Yep.
Yeah. Sure. Regardless. So this is something I found on Stack Exchange here. So I take this with a little grain of salt. But an ordinal represents the position of a number in a set with respect to an order. So whatever the order is, it's like, okay, that's the position. Like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 3 actually is the third number in that set. If it's 2, 4, 6, 8, then 4 is the second number in that set. So it's number 2, and that's the ordinal position. A set of fruits that contains the following: apple, mango, banana, grape. That set has a cardinality of 4. There are four things in there. There's the apple, there's the mango, there's the banana, and there's the grape. So if we say it's well-ordered, then the apple is the least element, so that's the first element, and the others are successive. So then mango would be apple plus one, because remember, the order goes apple, mango, banana, grape. And so the cardinality is four, and the ordinal refers to where it is in that position.
Interesting.
So when so what Brian Christian says on this podcast is, he says the difference between cardinal and ordinal information, which I think is kind of philosophically an extremely deep idea. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's relative versus kind of absolute in sure. a sense. So he says with ordinal information, you only know whether any two things are, which of them is better than the other. So with ordinal information, you only know which of them is better than the other, but you don't know by how much.
Yeah.
With cardinal information, you both know which of the things is better and you know by how much it is better. So by cardinal information, you can tell, okay, this is this position in the order of things. With ordinal, you can't really, really tell. And so when you reframe this in terms of cardinal versus ordinal position, that's when you get a 58% chance of picking the right candidate, as opposed to like the 37%. It changes the type of information that you're using here.
Yeah, so I think it's almost like giving a score. Like you take those dumb surveys that are like, I'm very likely, I'm extremely very likely, I am mid, I am less than mid, I am awful. Like that five score puts a number yes. on the thing instead of just ranking them and creating a subset within your larger set of 100. So it gets 37, you rank the number one. You don't rank why or how or what their absolute score was. So you are not able right. to recognize. Because if you were able to do that and give them a score, you could say, well, this person got essentially what I deem to be a 75 out of 100. You could come across people that are around the 70s and say, yeah, this is good enough. Or if you do it differently, you can be like, oh, this is a 90. We're definitely done here. This is insane. Like this is 15, like this, which 15 is like, what, it's 25, 33% better than a 75, whatever, 20%, whatever it is. 15 is 20% of 75.
I think you just said a lot of numbers here.
15 is 20% 15, of
75. No, 15 is 60% of, or no, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Right, right. I was thinking of 25. I was thinking of 25. I was wrong. I was so wrong. It's catastrophically wrong. 15 man. Is 20% of 75. You're
feels
right.
Good to be me knowing math. Yeah, so you can be substantially better. You can be 20% better than the person that you came across. However, if you don't do it that way, then you're just kind of, it really is like a one or a zero. Like this is, are you, you know, equal to this person that's the standard bearer? Are you better? And if you're not, I'm out of here. And that, it's not that, like what we're finding out here is like, it's, what is the, what are the odds that you will find the best candidate? And if you do it this way, it's 37%. If you put mathematical value on it, if you do it with cardinal information, it is 58%. That's more than half of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it much easier to kind of understand. I don't really know exactly how you do that, but I don't think that the finding that cardinality gives you more information, I don't think that that undermines the value of the secretary problem. And one of the complaints that people have in this Reddit thread is that this Medium article by Robert Wilbin, this was written in 2019, and it's basically saying, you know, the secretary problem is not a good match for real life, for decision-making. So don't use this anymore to understand decision-making. But I don't really know that that's necessarily true. And I think that this article kind of gives a bad name to an interesting mathematical exercise, but also a decent way of using imperfect information to try to make a good decision, or at least improving the chances of you're making a good decision.
You know, what's really interesting about this topic is that it seems so simple from that, like theoretically, if you're hiring a secretary or if you're dating, which we can kind of get into the other specific uses, but there are three or four Medium articles about this, which to me signifies like there are some nerdy people out there that have thoughts. For example, I guess I can share my screen, and I don't know what I have to do to get the whole article. Members only. I have to upgrade on Medium. Should I subscribe? Do we believe in paid for journalism? I think we do. Maybe I will subscribe. I don't think I'll ever use it.
Well, cancel it. You know, if you're trying to decide which subscription is the best service, you should rank them each in order.
Sure. So this is a member-only story.
Yep, see that shape right there, that blue shape you got? That is the Gaussian that we were talking about. That's right, the statistical distribution. Yeah, that's what that is.
So this guy calls the 37% rule, the dating rule, is purely probabilistic statistical theory, which I find interesting. This is the first time I have heard it be called that, the dating rule, this 36% thing, which I guess that makes sense, right? But if you break it down in terms of dating, the idea is that you give yourself, based on biology, a certain amount of time to find someone, and then you break that down into essentially thirds, and then you're like, okay, I have to find someone as good or better than the best person. And then you do what everyone does, which is you kind of crawl back to your ex, and you're like, maybe we could just be best friends, or maybe can we start over? I haven't found
For the record, neither of us did that. No. For the record, we did not do that, but that is what... in case... Actually, I don't know why we even caveat that with people. They're not listening to us.
Out of that landmine. No thanks, man.
Well, never, and they're never going to hear this.
No,
your lovely
no
spouse,
one is, really.
My lovely fiance, they are never going to hear this. Yeah, no. It doesn't matter at all. But in any case, it's called the dating problem by some people. It's called the marriage problem by others. This guy, Theodore Hill, wrote a piece in The American Scientist about this kind of optimal stopping question. And I don't think he described the secretary problem. If he did, I must have skimmed past it. Sure. But he does describe the marriage problem. And so it's like, okay, we're approaching this, like, how much time do I need to spend dating in order to figure out that I found, you know, kind of the one. And he really describes this basically in the same setup as the secretary. So, you know, he says, you know, this problem has a long and rich history in the mathematics literature. It's known variously as the marriage, secretary, dowry, or best choice problem. Mm-hmm. So really, to be fair to people who are on kind of the dating scene, and to be fair to people who practice as office administrators, or to people who are politically appointed to high positions of government and don't like the use of the term secretary, this problem has been known by many
names.
Yeah. But the basic idea is essentially the same. And so I think this is an interesting way. I think it does have a lot of value. The article from Medium, though, this piece from Robert Wiblin, it says, okay, there are some real problems with the way the secretary problem is set up, though. And he's got, I mean, he's got 11 objections to the way that 11? This doesn't really match up with real life.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so we'll just go through them here.
Let's hear. I'm ready.
So first, people aren't only ranked by how desirable they are; they have cardinal or relative goodness. That doesn't really make a ton of sense.
Sure.
You don't only care about maximizing the probability of choosing the best person in a sample, with every other outcome being equally bad. He says instead you want to do something like maximize the desirability of the person that you do get. So. Mm-hmm. I don't really know if I think that's a subtle distinction. So you can often go back to previous candidates even if you didn't initially accept them in real life. Yeah, because so the secretary problem is like, all right, we've rejected this candidate. I guess you could go back in the secretary problem. Theoretically, you don't have to make a decision, but in the way the problem is framed, that mathematical function where you get this negative x times natural log of x solution, that does depend on having a finite set and you have to go in order. Yeah. So yeah, that doesn't really make sense. It says you can cheaply find out a lot about the distribution of candidates you're drawing from just by observing the world around you, asking other people in the industry and so on. Like for example, if you're hiring a secretary and they do not know how to read, that would be an easy way to reject them. You don't really need to spend time doing that. And that's why they have like, well, and that's, you know, when we're talking about this as a secretary thing and not as a dating thing, I don't think literacy is necessarily a disqualifier for people to be romantically involved, but in the real world,
honestly,
yeah, absolutely. You don't
host it. No, even.
No. Yeah. Well, I think you and I are both heroic examples of that.
Litterish. We're litterish.
Litterish. But the point is there are automatic screening processes for a position like this one that, you know, that's not really going to be the case. He says also, we don't really know how many candidates there are going to be in a big city. There might be more possible job applicants than you could test in a lifetime.
True.
I've heard rumors that there are certain agencies in this area that get, you know, thousands and thousands of applications every day. And I don't doubt that. You know, there are a lot of young people who want to come out.
So I worked in sports, and I will tell you that. If an organization like for sports media is hiring, like let's just use the New York Times, if they're hiring a reporter position, they will get X applicants, and it is about the same for every single beat. And on average, in journalism, it's about the same. It goes up or down, plus or minus. Some have more, some have less. Some people are expensive, whatever. In sports, it's somewhere between 50 to 200 to 1. So if a reporter position at New York Times gets 100, you can bank on somewhere between 300 and 1,000 applicants for that role.
And there's no way that you could screen all of them individually. I mean, what did we say earlier? Each one takes an hour to interview, and that would be 2.5 weeks of work for 100 people. Yep. You couldn't do it. You have to screen them out.
No. And that's where AI can come in. How about that? So let's finish up by telling the story about how I bought my house. And I'll make this quick because people don't like this. Because this kind of happened to me. The secretary thing happened to me. And I can tell you the thing that I believe as game theorists is to promote aggression. Be aggressive, but also understand that boring is hot. It is okay to just take the first one that you like. Because boring, what happened to us
Hold on, Nick. Boring is hot. We can't emphasize that enough. No, remember, this is a game theory podcast. Sure. You know the Nash equilibrium. The reason they call it the Nash equilibrium and then the opposite corner is the sucker's payoff.
Sucker's payoff.
Because you're going to get suckered by being too aggressive. You got to do the boring thing. Don't cooperate.
Chris, I posit here that the boring thing is the aggressive thing. If you prioritize the boring thing, you're being aggressive. You're being smartly aggressive.
If you prioritize the boring thing, you're being aggressive. Are you being aggressive or are you being prudent?
So we're looking for a house. The market is the market. There are benefits. There are drawbacks. Price, age, good bones, bad bones, location, location, location. Let's say that there are about 9 houses that we're looking at and are reasonable candidates. Of those 9 houses, there was one. It was the first one that we saw. I saw it by myself and I was like, that's the one. However, we were kind of scared off by our realtor. Because they're like, it's going to be too much money. Like, it's like there's going to be a bidding war. So you're like, all right. So then we looked at the other houses. I'm like, what's the best one of this subset? And so we don't have to come back and look at all these other ones because we can kind of weed out based on location. Looked at that one, made an offer. It was a disaster. You ever heard the phrase, it has good bones? This one.
I hear that. I hear people say that when they want to sound. That it has good bones. Old. It's very old. We had to staple on the central air to the house years after the fact. That's the equivalent of like when Callie's watching hockey with me, which usually doesn't last very long.
Sure.
But she'll say things like, oh, there's a lot of hockey left to be played.
That's
doesn't matter what time is left in the game.
Such a great thing to say. It works even better.
That's right. If you're walking through a house, like it could be up to no code, built in 1912, with no eye to human occupants, doorways the size of hobbit holes, no real reliable plan. You can just go, oh, well, you know, but I think it has good bones.
Right, exactly. It's the thing that people say when they're like, yeah, there's like the good underlying foundation is there, which like, oh, yeah, it's a nice house. It's well built. Then you find the inspection and it turns out it did not have good bones. So we had to return and it turns out that the house that we wanted the most was the house that was there. We were just so infatuated with it and our realtor kind of scared us that we didn't see the pitfalls of it and why it would be on the market for a little bit longer than it ended up being on the market. So what I'm saying is that sometimes the first candidate through the door is the one. If you ever watch Say Yes to the Dress, which we did, it is our tax to watch football on Saturdays. We watch Say Yes to the Dress. Sometimes the first dress you try on is fine. Sometimes you know the situation. You will find yourself going through. In fact, you know what? The optimal dress thing is actually, I think, a better version of this problem because it ties in emotion. It ties in emotion to this. It really does. I think that's a much better way to look at it. And can I just say, as a sidebar, I wish I had made a TikTok to Swifties when they were getting into football, things that they could say to impress any of their friends or significant others, men specifically in their lives, like girlfriends and wives. I would tell them 2 things. One, just say there's a lot of football left to be played.
Yes.
Anytime.
Evergreen.
Literally Evergreen until statement. The Super Bowl was a great game.
You could
literally
have said that in
until
overtime.
The last like play, there's a lot of football left. Yes. Thing number 2, just shake your head or nod your head. Shake your head for bad, nod your head for good, and just say it's a simple game.
It's a simple game. Yes.
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 Like so. Like absolutely so. Your team gets correct. A penalty. Be like, it's a simple game. It's a simple game, guys. It's simple.
That's a good one.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's my new one for this year. All right, Chris. Well, what you were saying?
Well, you do have really. It's not a TikTok, but you do have a resource for non-sports experts.
That's true.
Podcast called Interesting.
Now that we've wrapped up the stable marriage problem and you have, or the secretary problem, and you have found
only one of us
new
has.
Lodgings, and I have found my new lodgings. I wanted to say, I forgot where I was going with this. Oh my God, I just brain farted.
Where are you?
First time
this
ever happened to me.
Live.
It was so much dumber than you could possibly imagine. It was so much dumber than you could possibly imagine. And I'm going to work through it.
You know,
we're going to fight it.
I don't think you should undersell my imagination. I've been on this show with you the whole time. I can imagine some pretty dumb things.
There's more to Newman than meets the eye, Chris.
There's less.
There's less. Did you know, I saw, speaking of that, the University of Utah tweeted at BYU Athletics and called them Newman.
Newman. Can't wait to see those guys back in action again this year. That? Good luck to BYU with the optimal wife problem. At least in some cases, you have many options.
Yep.
Depends on who you ask.
Depends on who you ask.